Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Community in Depth. We are thrilled to have in studio with us today Deacon Rod Walker. Deacon Walker is a deacon with the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and we're very excited to chat with him about St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, the saint. And she is celebrating, or we are celebrating, the 50th anniversary of her canonization. So just thought, who would be better than Deacon Rod Walker to fill us in? How have you been?
I've been good. Busy summer.
Oh, Rod, I know it is, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm loving the weather right now. This is my zone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of feels like fall, coming into fall. Well, before we go too much further, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Church is celebrating the canonization on September 14th with a celebration. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so St. Elizabeth Ann Seton was made a saint by Pope John Paul VI on September 14th, 1975, so that's 50 years ago. And there's also some other things happening at the parish where a group got together and said, hey, let's celebrate this in a particular way. Something like Fall Festival, but not a Fall Festival, a little smaller, but they'll have food and games for the kids and things like that. So the main celebration is at Mass, 10 a.m. Mass on Sunday the 14th. Bishop Eisen will be there to dedicate the new altar that just finally was put in. And that's kind of a big thing in and of itself to dedicate an altar in a church from a Catholic tradition. So there'll be that going on. And then after that is when the celebration begins.
It's very appropriate on the feast day.
Yeah, very appropriate.
Or it's actually not her feast day.
Well,
that's
it's
in
not
January.
Her feast day. Yeah,
yeah,
January 4th, 3rd or 4th.
I think it's the 4th. Yes.
That's her death date.
Her death date. Okay.
Yeah, usually a saint will have their day, their feast day on their death date.
Okay.
Which is their birth date to heaven.
No kidding. Right. Yeah. Oh, Rod. Well, let's chat about St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. I've read a couple books about her, and she is really an interesting woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you have some history that you want to share.
Yeah, sure. She was born in the United States previous to the Revolutionary War. So she is the first sort of native-born American saint, if you will, when she was created as a saint in 1975. She was married, had a family.
Grew up Episcopal.
Yeah, she was a convert. She grew up as an Episcopal and was married, had 5 children, I believe.
And such tragedy.
Yeah. Yep.
Quite a few of them passed away.
Right, and her husband passed away.
Luckily.
Yeah, so he had
tuberculosis,
and so the doctors at that time in the very early 1800s, their remedy was for him to go to Italy, who he had business contacts there. They were quite wealthy, quite well-to-do. They lived in New York City proper, which was all down in Lower Town Manhattan in the financial district today. That was New York City at the time. There was nothing else there. So they went, his wife Elizabeth and one of their daughters went to Italy. And as soon as he got there, he got sicker and sicker, and then he passed away there. And prior to that, they had lost the business too. There was a lot of shipping. I don't know if you call it piracy or not, but the British were not happy with the United States prior to the War of 1812.
Of course.
So if they'd see a United States ship sailing by, they would seize it and take what's on there,
mm-hmm.
and call it legal, you know, legal piracy, I guess. So William Seton, I think he lost 4 or 5 of his ships full of all of his goods, and he just couldn't handle that load, so he
lost his business.
Because
they were really wealthy,
family. Yeah, very wealthy.
They were well thought of in the New York society area.
Yeah, as a Protestant Episcopalian family, very high society. And so when Elizabeth came back and had a fire in her heart for something different, that was a very, very challenging time in her life because she was basically cast aside by her societal friends that she wanted to be Catholic. And so she paid a heavy price for that.
Well, and let's talk about that Italian family that she went to live with, the friends of, it would be William Seton.
Yeah.
And they really had, they were a Catholic family, and they had a profound impact on her from a faith standpoint also.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So Elizabeth witnessed what the Catholic faith was about firsthand from a devout Catholic family. And she got to see what their hunger was to receive Christ in the Eucharist and started figuring out in her head what that meant And then the Holy Spirit put it in her heart. And then she knew that's what she wanted. So when she got back to New York eventually, that, you know, it took some time in those days.
Of course.
She sought some counsel from the local Catholic church, which was St. Peter's, the only Catholic church in New York City at that time. And I was reading about that a little bit too. The Catholic community was very small in New York City at that time. And they wanted to build a church, but the city wouldn't allow them to build it in the city limits. So they built it outside of the city limits, which is where it exists today. It's a new building compared to what it was then, but it's down in the financial, it's right across from the World Trade Center is where that is.
And is that because there was a little bit of prejudice against the Catholics back then?
Yeah, actually a lot of it back then, to be honest with you. And when she was received into the church, a year later, she was confirmed, and the only there was only one bishop in the colonies at that time. So in 1804, that bishop had to come from Baltimore to confirm her in New York City. And that was no small journey, right?
Mm-mm.
So life was a little different for Catholics in colonial America than most people might think. And that, you know, the world goes through these periods where they, you know, they do things maybe they regret later. You know, I don't know. But anyway, and she had such a great hunger for the Eucharist that when she first was received into the church, she would run from her house to receive the Eucharist. And I don't see too many people running towards our church for the Eucharist, but she would run. I mean, literally, she wanted to get there as quickly as she could. And so anyway, she's a beautiful heart for the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm. So she did have a very tough life, but as she was raising the end of her kids, you know, this was all happening while she still had younger children.
Right, exactly.
And then some of her kids passed away.
Yep.
It just must have been just a terrible time, a horrific time.
Yeah.
But yet she continued on, and she really is credited for being the founder of the U.S. parochial school system.
Right, especially girls related, focused on girls' education.
Yes.
There was not much of that at the time, and she was doing some of that after her husband passed away.
Kind of without formally doing it, informally.
Yeah, and then when she became Catholic, all the clients, they said, we're not going to be part of that. So she was really struggling just to make ends meet, and she lived with her father and the kids for some time. And at some point, she thought, well, New York is just not a welcoming place for me as a Catholic. And so she was going to move to Quebec, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of French-Canadian Catholics up there. And she met a priest that was visiting down in New York City and said, why don't you come with me to Emmitsburg, Maryland? And that's how she made that decision then, to not go to Canada, but to go to Maryland. And that's where she founded her school and her order. The first order formed in the United States was by her, too.
The Sisters of Charity.
Sisters of Charity, yep, which are still around today.
Such an amazing woman. And then when you think about it, she died at the age of 46.
Yeah. You know, we think that's pretty young. Maybe not so much young back then, but still young, I mean.
Well, still young to really accomplish as much as she did.
Right, very much so, yep. And so our Catholic church in town is in 1988 or so, after that was all combined, and I don't know who made that decision, but
it was a committee.
Was it a committee?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and hopefully, I think they were probably inspired by the Holy Spirit. It's a beautiful church. To have her as our patroness is a very beautiful thing.
It is.
And be such a giving, loving person, especially toward children.
And I think the fact that the St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Church community in Hastings has a school is very appropriate as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know how many years ago it was, maybe pushing 20 now, I suppose. My family and I visited her shrine in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and up at Mount St. Mary Seminary. And I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea. There's a rock. That's the best way. It's just a rock, pretty good sized rock, that's in the ground there. And I just read a little plaque that said this is where Mother Seton would teach the children from here. She would sit on the rock, and then they would sit around her, and she would teach them. And the rock had kind of like an old tractor seat sort of form to it, you know? And so I sat on the rock, and I thought, this is the most comfortable rock I've ever sat on in my life. It just fit like a seat. And somewhere down the line then, someone donated a statue of Mother Seton teaching children, and she's at our parish sitting on that very same rock. That rock is just a very special rock to me.
I bet it is,
I sat there, and just it was very peaceful, and so anyway.
Well, she certainly was a visionary.
very much so.
In a time when she had a lot of things against her?
Yeah, lots of things against her. And that didn't, I'm sure there were days where she struggled.
For sure.
Right, but she had to have a deep prayer life. She just had to.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, that would have all just said, I'm done. I'm not going to go through this anymore. You know.
Well, especially losing her husband,
mm-hmm.
losing their income, losing their house, and then one by one losing quite a few of her children.
Right, right.
So, yes, just a remarkable woman. She did pass away in 1821
mm-hmm.
at the age of 46. And as you mentioned, she's interred today at the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton in Emmitsburg, Maryland. But this canonization process started way over, gosh, like 150 years later almost.
Yeah, a long time later.
So
yeah.
Can you kind of talk about an overview of the canonization process in the Catholic Church and then some of the miracles that were associated with her, please?
Sure. And let me kind of just maybe start by explaining that there is a very well-defined process for someone to be recognized as a saint. The Catholic Church doesn't wave its wand and say, oh, you're a saint. They simply recognize that based on this person's life, there is no other possible outcome other than this person lives a saintly life in heaven. And so for her, it actually didn't start until 1936. Some group of people submitted her writings, which were at that point 100 and some years old, to the Vatican to say, hey, this woman was very special, and here are some of her writings. And so that sort of opens the case, if you will, for the Catholic Church then to begin their investigation process. That process can go decades, and often does. I mean, more recently with Pope Francis, that was moving a lot quicker. But, in, you know, 100 years ago, it could take 100 years. I'm serious about that. So in this case, it probably took like 40 years, I think, if you do the math on this. So they formally opened that. So they got the documents in 1936. Then the church opened it in 1940. And then things got a little hairy, I suppose, with World War II and everything else. You know, that takes business a little longer. But then in 1952, there was a miracle of a little girl who, I think the caregiver, she had leukemia, and the caregiver nurse was praying for the intercession of Elizabeth Ann Seton. She wasn't a saint at the time. And the little girl was cured, no medical reason for the cure. And then that all has to be investigated, and that often takes years and years. So then she becomes, from the church's perspective, once they approve that first miracle, she becomes what they term her as blessed. So she would have been Blessed Elizabeth Ann Seton for quite some time. We have a blessed that was born and grew up very near to us here, Blessed Solanus Casey. So he's in the process of that same review, and he's had one miracle that's been certified from the church. And so now they wait for the second. So when the second comes, then they get the title of canonization or sainthood. And that second miracle goes through the same kind of rigor, can take a decade, can take longer. But, you know, these days there are the science behind that is much easier, more accessible, and easier to prove, you know, that kind of stuff.
So it can go quicker.
It can go quicker, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, like mm-hmm. Blessed soon-to-be Saint Carlo Acutis, he's going pretty quickly, mm-hmm. you know, compared to, you know, maybe two or three generations back, it would have taken a century
mm-hmm.
in some cases, you know, to, mm-hmm. to do that. So it's a very well thought out process, very much peer reviewed, on and on and on, review after review after review.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like if they find one thing that's suspect, it's over. And that doesn't mean the person still isn't in heaven, but that the church won't recognize them in that same way,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Saint with a capital S.
Yes.
So can you please explain the canonization process and the way that we as Catholics pray for the intercession okay. of saints? Because I think a lot of people think that we hold saints at the same level as we do our Lord.
Yeah, which we absolutely do not. Another kind of confusing subject for non-Catholics is our reverence of Jesus's mother, Mary. And with a little bit of research, people could check this out, that in ancient Middle Eastern culture, you know, you'd have king over different regions. The queen was never, ever the king's wife. One of the main reasons for that is kings typically had multiple wives. So figure that one out, right? Who's going to be queen? That's one of the practical things there. The queen was always the king's mother. And, you know, if you were a noble or somebody like that, you could have access to the king. But common people would never, ever, ever get access to the king. It's just not going to happen. Their access to the king was through an intercession with the queen. And so when you understand that's how in Jesus's time, and there are some countries in the Middle East, and I don't know which ones, they still work that way with their king and queen relationship. It's always the mother. But when you understand that that intercession was always through the queen, always through the mother, that's what Catholics are doing. We're just asking for intercession. I guess, you know, when I was in trouble as a kid, would I ask my mom for intercession? Yeah, once in a while, you know. Mom, dad's coming home. I think I'm done here. Yeah, when he gets here, you know, soften him up before he gets to me. That kind of stuff, right? So a lot of people would say they understand that.
Now I understand, yes.
Yeah, we go to our moms, you know. And that's what we do as Catholics. We don't worship her. We just reverence her position as Christ's mother. Mm-hmm. And so a saint, she is the queen of all saints. She is the, you know, the saint par excellence, so to speak. But the other saints are in that same court, right? So if we need something, you know, something that's in our life that we really would like some extra intercession for, it's absolutely from our tradition, totally normal and fine to pray for intercession of a saint. And I do that very often. A lot of Catholics do that. Mm-hmm. I have my posse of saints that I will use as intercessors, and never overriding Jesus, just that's the way we do it. And some people say, well, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just go to Jesus? Well, because he's the king, she's the queen, the saints are in that court. They have a purpose in that court, and I'm going to take all advantage I can of that, especially when I might be in a little bit of trouble spiritually. Why wouldn't you take advantage of that, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's Catholic tradition. So.
That's a good explanation. So St. Elizabeth Ann Seton did, in fact, get a second miracle.
Yeah, that came, I think it was in the early 60s. There was a man who had meningitis who had hours to live, and he was miraculously cured of that. So then that took that second miracle, which took review. And in this case, it was 12 years of review before she was actually officially recognized as a saint in the church. Again, never taking those things lightly as they do that. And since that time, there could be hundreds and hundreds. And some of those the church would investigate. Still, they would look at those. But very many of them, they would just go, yep, well, of course, she's a saint. You know, she would do that for you.
Well, we have an opportunity to honor her. St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Day is going to be September 14th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Church. And it's going to be a day of joy and fun and games and family things. And all are invited.
Yeah, and all invited. Some of it's outside. So we should probably pray for her intercession for good weather. The Knights of Columbus, there'll be food, no charge. I'll be like this, I think it's like hot dogs and
how fun,
hamburgers and beverages, and so that'll be outside, and some things inside, and some kid games and things like that after 10 o'clock Mass.
Wonderful. So, yeah. Thank you so much. What a great conversation about the Saint, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. We really appreciate it. Deacon Rod Walker, and you are listening to another edition of Community in Depth on AM 1460 and FM 97.7 KDWA in Hastings. To pray.